This is a reflection of deep economic ruptures, especially in the U.S. economy. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. John Edmonds, professor of finance at Babson College Wellesley in Wellesley, Mass., joins us. Also joining us is Peter Koenig, former World Bank economist, who joins us from Lima over in Peru. Gentlemen, welcome to you both. John Edmonds, I'll first start with you. And this is a general question as to see where you stand on this banking crisis, where it's now deepening, obviously. And we're looking at banks, other banks that are feeling the heat, and U.S. stock markets are not doing well. What are we looking at here, John Edmonds?
It's a specific failure of a bank that invested the money coming in a way which was riskier than it should have been, and then they didn't do hedging. It's not the first part of a massive systemic financial crisis like what we had in 2008, 2009. That was a completely different story.
What makes you so sure that it's not a beginning of a wider problem?
Well, it is a wider problem, but what it's doing is it's putting the spotlight on every bank in the world that isn't doing very well. The bad boy of the moment is Credit Suisse, but they do not have any problem with a maturity mismatch in their bond portfolio. They don't have any massive increase in non-performing loans. What they don't have is they don't have a long-term way of making a profit. Their costs are too high, their revenue is too low, and that's not new. So that stock had been getting hit for a long time. The answer of the Saudis was baked in. They should have known what they were going to be told, because the Saudis couldn't go over 10% ownership of the shares, or it would trigger other factors, that other regulatory issues that they didn't want to deal with. And I think also what they really need to do, what Credit Suisse needs to do, is downsize. They've been doing it for years, but they don't seem to be able to do it fast enough.
Peter Koenig, you heard our guest there. Do you agree with what he said?
Yes and no. I would like to add something which so far nobody has actually made the connection to. I think this could be a potential systemic crisis which goes far, far beyond the 2008-2010 crisis, because so far nobody has really officially made the connection to the World Economic Forum, which has said already a long time ago, and it's mentioned in the Great Reset, that there will be a banking crisis. And how do they do that? I mean, it's playing out in front of our eyes, and we can't see it, or we don't want to see it. Behind this banking crisis that has been building up for a long time, behind this banking crisis is an internal crisis of derivatives. You know, these banks, especially the big banks, the so-called systemic banks, big banks, they used to be called too big to fail. They have enormous amounts of outstanding derivatives which are not really money. That's casino money. It's the money that has never been created. It's created just by speculation, and by fast speculation only by financial institutions and banks. So estimates of outstanding, nobody knows exactly how much is outstanding, but estimates range from between $500 trillion to over $250 billion in derivatives outstanding by the biggest banks, and you know, I'm talking about, not even talking about BlackRock, Vanguard, and State Street, but mostly those that are listed and working with Wall Street, like Citibank, Bank of America, Chase, Morgan, and so on. Those have enormous amounts of outstanding. You can imagine what that means. If somebody talks about that, it creates a crisis immediately, and people are going to be afraid. Okay. And we know what the media can do these days. So I think this is part of the reason that this crisis is being generated now.
All right. Before I move on to John Edmonds to get a reaction, can you tell us what the WEF warning was?
Well, this is not new.
John Edmonds, hold on. Let me get. Okay, well, why don't you go ahead? This is the warning that I looked up, and it said governments have leveraged cheap money to invest in future growth and to help stabilize distressed financial systems. And I guess there talks about an exorbitant amount of money. What do you think?
Well, yes, I agree with the previous expert. I thought he was also going to mention the exposure to emerging markets. which are always vulnerable to any situation like this, specifically with regard to derivatives. The figure that was tossed around years ago was $600 trillion face value of derivatives. And just for reference, that would be maybe five times the value of annual output in the world. But most of the derivatives are for other purposes, or they're supposed to be actually reducing risk. This is the mistake that the Silicon Valley Bank didn't hedge. They bought long-term bonds and then did not sell them for a future delivery. So you could say their specific problem was not enough derivatives or not the right ones. But you're quite right that the derivatives are really kind of hidden from view most of the time because of the way they're reported. So you could argue that the precarious nature of the entire world financial system is once again on display. Most of the entities in it have adequate protection, and they also have backing from their government. But we have a bigger threat coming on, which is the House of Representatives might not raise the debt ceiling for the U.S. Treasury, in which case, probably in June or July, the U.S. Treasury would be actually unable to pay bonds that were being presented for redeeming. When a bond matures, you can deliver it to the Treasury, and they're supposed to give you cash, but they wouldn't be able to do that.
Okay. Perhaps that speaks to the wider U.S. economy there. But let's rewind a little bit here, Peter Koenig. On the one hand, you have this Silicon Valley Bank that made the announcement on a Wednesday, and by Saturday, the bank's doors were shut and the announcement was made. And on the other hand, you have the way that this is being reported, and we're going by the way that various news outlets are reporting this, that you have stocks that are in sell-off mode, but this is the part that's most important, that there are worries that more lenders could fail. How is it that you have institutions, organizations that are supposed to monitor this, like the SEC in the U.S. and others, and yet you have these bank failures that are showing up the way they do, especially at warp speed, may I add, in the case of SVB? I mean, aren't they supposed to be monitoring this? And how could they not know that other banks are in distress unless they don't want to make that announcement yet, because it would obviously lead to more public outrage and worry, and obviously that could spell, for example, a run on the banks?
Well, right. I mean, the point is that they do know. It's not that they don't know, but the government knows, and the so-called regulatory agencies, which they are practically none anymore for the banking sector, they are aware of the risk, and they are purposefully they don't do anything. And why? I mean, the banking sector has been largely deregulated by the Clinton administration in 1999. This has been then a big scandal and has made the round in the media, but in the meantime has been forgotten. Nothing has changed. The banking, particularly as far as derivatives concerned, is still totally deregulated. So the banks can do whatever they want. They can lend and borrow whatever they want. They don't have a ceiling anymore. They used to have ceilings. This is all gone. And now comes the fact that we also have to mention, because there are many dimensions to this, the Federal Reserve has, within the last half a year or so, has rapidly increased the interest rates to levels which has not been seen during the last three decades, at least. You know, and that has made banks insecure, has lenders made insecure, businesses also, of course. So they became very much scared of borrowing money. And this has contributed also to a contraction of the banking sector. On the other hand, the interest rates, the increase of interest rates have brought a shock, sure, in not only to the banking sector as a whole, but only to business, and so they have become, mm-hmm, very much cautious on what they are gonna do in the future. Now, why is the banking sector not being regulated? I mean, it's almost totally deregulated, and there are parts of the banking sector which should be at least regulated or abandoned altogether. Like I find the casino money play, the sure. games with derivatives should be stopped or at least regulated. But there's such a strong lobbying from the big financial institutions with Congress that this hasn't happened and doesn't happen probably within the foreseeable future until a catastrophe will happen. And, okay. and so these are additional facts that need to be added into this potential crisis.
Sure. John Edmonds, let's talk about these interest rates topic here, because what we're looking at is both SVB and Signature Bank, that's another bank that went bankrupt, there were actually, from what the report says, they were overly exposed to assets whose values came under pressure from rising interest rates. Tell us how that leads to the banks closing down. What it means?
Well, let me just describe bank regulation as it was classically imposed at the end of the 1980s. A bank is supposed to have stockholders' equity equal to or greater than 8% of risky assets, and their bonds are not supposed to be risky. But what happened was those banks bought long-term fixed-rate bonds, which then declined in value because of their rising interest rates. So instead of their loan portfolio being a source of headaches, it was their bond portfolio, and suddenly they found themselves in a situation where by operation of rules, they would have to be liquidated. But the point about derivatives that the other person is mentioning is entirely correct. As say, they were supposed to be regulated in the Dodd-Frank law, and the documents that were floating around after that were not really decisive. So it's possible, if you're clever, to circumvent the regulation and take advantage of the very low cost money. The other relevant point is that interest rates were very low in Japan from 1990 onward, and in the rest of the world from the year 2000 onward, and especially from 2008 onward. So bankers lived there pretty much their entire career in a very low interest rate environment, and they were expecting that the low interest rates would continue. So they took in deposits on which they were offering to pay very low interest rates, and then they invested the money in something that was supposed to yield more, which it would do, except that then when interest rates went up, their cost of money went up and their return on portfolio went down. So they were still getting the coupon payments from these bonds, but they suffered a capital loss on the bonds. And that was fatal for at least two of them.
Okay, so let's try to break that down. Peter Koenig, what our guest there said. If I was somebody watching this, I might be a little confused, but let me see if this makes sense, whether I'm right in looking at it this way, because maybe some viewers might also look at it this way. So you have the bank. They took in the money from an average person, and they took that money and they invested it in something else. But because the interest rates on the money rose, the bank was not able to make the money back in terms of the ratio or the percentage that it wanted to, and it fell short in terms of giving the money back to the customer?
If you take in money from a depositor and tell them you're going to pay them 1%, and then you take that money and invest it in something that's supposed to yield 4%, that's 4% isn't really high enough to cover the bank's cost of salary and overhead and things like that. But suppose that we just talk about 4% and 1%. It should be making 3%, but what happens on that is they couldn't consistently make enough on the money that they were lending out, and so they went to other things which were maybe more speculative, and that will come out soon.
How long has this been going on, you think?
Well, it's been going on for quite a long while since after Dodd-Frank, which was in 2010. There was supposed to be a regulation about derivatives, and they tossed that back and forth. And I only followed it for a while, but every 6 months.
But the interest rates have been going up for the past year, haven't they?
Well, yeah, but exactly. I mean, with regard to the accounting for derivatives and regulating.
Okay, let me get Peter Koenig back in here, John Edmonds. So since 2010, Dodd Franklin is what our guest there talked about. Sorry to have cut you off there, John Edmonds.
No, go ahead.
Peter Koenig, to you. Since 2010, as our guest there said, since Dodd Franklin, but more specifically in the past year or so, when the Fed stepped in to raise interest rates to try to tame inflation. So they've known about this, I'm guessing, in the past year. But now we're seeing the results, or now is the time that we're seeing things unfold. Is that correct, Peter Koenig?
Yes, I would agree with that. And what has actually happened during this long period of low interest rates or almost zero interest rates, you know, the banking system has become laissez-faire, sort of has taken a laissez-faire attitude in terms of lending particularly, and have not looked very much at the risks, because the risks were kind of low with the low interest rates. They didn't risk very much, but they could produce money for the system. As you know, in the U.S., probably more than 95% of the money generated in circulation is made by the private banks by establishing loans, not by the Federal Reserve. So all of that has helped the private banking sector enormously. Now suddenly there is a surge of interest rates, as you said, within the last year or so, to what it is now, close to 5% or something like that. This is enormous, from zero within a year, and that of course reflects on the lending. This is just for prime lenders, and that has an enormous impact, as I mentioned before, not only on business itself, but also on the banks, and therefore this is certainly a point that has to be taken very much into account. In the current crisis.
So you have what's going on in the States, and then you have now what has happened overseas. John Edmonds, taking a look at bank shares that have fallen in Asia and in Europe, of course, stock markets also. But in particular, what seems to be making some noise here is Credit Suisse, where there has been, it's closed down 30%, it's nosedived to a historic low. You have the U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders saying that everybody is concerned about the impact of Credit Suisse problems on the U.S. banking system. And you have the U.S. Treasury officials who are monitoring the problems, and they're contacting their, counterparts. So doesn't that mean that there is exposure? And it sounds like they're not saying something about this, but exposure, I mean that, you know, these banks are related, these financial institutions, banks, to their overseas, to the banks overseas. Are we correct in this?
Oh yes, absolutely. They have lines of credit with each other, but also the central banks have lines of credit with each other, and they're constantly in communication with each other. But I wouldn't limit it to Credit Suisse. The two largest banks in Germany have been operating below book value per share for most of the past 15 years, and they make a little bit of money one quarter and lose a little bit the next quarter, but they're not really earning enough to be staying in business. But that's moving right on. I'd mentioned the Japanese banks, which depended on zero interest rates for the longest time, and interest rates in Japan have been held still in the 1% range and finally are being allowed to creep up in the 2% range. But even that is traumatic for a country that had effectively 0% interest from 1990 onward. You could have a very successful career in banking in Japan, allocating money that isn't really costing you anything, and you didn't really have to charge the borrowers very much for the money either. So they could borrow money, and then when it came time to pay it back, they could just borrow some more and use the new money to pay the old money.
Okay.
That's now coming to roost.
Exactly. And that's what we're looking at. And it seems like, Peter Koenig, that this easy money is at the heart of the problem, isn't it? Isn't that the real fact here? But if it's easy money and they took it, they being the banks, financial institutions, or what have you, why were they not able to generate enough money in order for them not to see the day that we're seeing now? Because from what we understand, the easy money stopped within the past year. Isn't that correct?
I would say within the last 6 to 12 months. That is correct. But you know, this is a very short period of time for the banks to refinance themselves after having been overly exposed and taking many risks. This is a very short period of time, especially since it's the banks themselves who have taken advantage of the low interest rates and created more money by giving more credit to institutions which may have been not the most risk-free institutions or businesses. So I think, yes, This is one thing. Then secondly, I don't believe that many people have foreseen what was going to happen in terms of interest rate increases. Yes, we have been told before that the Fed will increase interest rates, and as a consequence, usually Europe does too. And so, yes, this was out there, but it has not happened for such a long time, and we were crying wolf for too long. And so eventually when it started happening, nobody was really prepared. Sure. And this is what's playing out today. This is part of what's playing out today. Okay. But I would like to come back to the other factor with which we started, and this is the derivatives, because we have also publicity. You know, we have the media that say anything they are paid to say. And if they make propaganda with the overextension on derivatives of the banks, that has an immediate impact, maybe not on the direct consumer, the small consumers, but on businesses. And if we look at these, and of course these big banks, they know that. If they have a quadrillion outstanding, I don't know exactly, nobody knows the figure, but let's put it that way. A quadrillion is about 10 times more than the current world GDP. Can you imagine? A quadrillion of casino money compared to created money with the world's GDP. So if that floats out, you have an enormous for this kind of angst created, and people may actually not just run the banks for their cash, but banks also may start running other banks for their outstanding derivatives. Right. And that creates a
Sorry to jump in, because we just have a minute left here, and I'd like to go to you, John Edmund. So whatever happened to the U.S. President Joe Biden, words of assurances didn't really pan out, did he? Did it? I mean, he said, one of the quotes, no losses will be borne by the taxpayers. Let me repeat that, no losses that the taxpayers have to pay. But at the same time, we know that some of the bank fees obviously play into that, that the taxpayers will have to pay for it. But he's not making that much of a dent in the sentiment out there. And final question to you, John Edmonds, how are you and your friends feeling about this? I'm just wondering, generally speaking, the American public, are you guys thinking we should take our money out of the bank? Is that the general sentiment?
Some do, but I personally am not worried at all because of what Joe Biden said. That is to say, there are guarantee funds in existence that can buttress the banks. This was a guarantee fund that was created in the 1930s called the FDIC, and then a second one which came out of Dodd-Frank, and that part did work. But still, I think it is correct that the taxpayers ultimately will suffer if there's any economic downturn. They would make less money, but they wouldn't be on the hook definitely for bailing out a bank, and specifically bank executives will not walk away from this with enormous severance packages. I really don't expect that. This will be different in that regard.
Thank you very much. We're going to unfortunately have to end in there. John Edmonds, professor of finance at Babson College in Wellesley. Thank you. Peter Koenig, former World Bank economist from Lima, Peru. Thanks. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Mika Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, depending on Allah. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In today's lesson, we will talk about the depending on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala is the one who is the creator of all, who has created everything, whatever we see in the worlds, in the universe, it is all being created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. On the other hand, we see that Allah has created mankind free, and this freedom that He has given us, that He did not create us as the slaves, as those who are being slave, He created us free, and He also says in the Quran that we have created you as a free man. So there is no one who's been created as a slave. Everyone is created as a free man. So this freedom that he has given us, and obviously he has given us some potentials as well. Those potentials with which boy can become a doctor, he can become an engineer, he can become a lecturer. So potentially he has perfection in him. He has the capability of becoming anything and choosing any profession. It depends on him which way he selects, but this potential was given by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. So when we see this in our life, we see that Allah has created us as the human who are potentially perfect. They can go towards perfection and wherever they want. Therefore, when Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has created us in such a way, then obviously it is an obligation on us. It is necessary that we must depend on Him and no one else, because it is Him who can help us in the best way. Welcome back. You're listening to A to Z from IRB English Radio. We were talking about the topic of depending on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And we said that Allah has created us potentially perfect. There is a narration from Imam Zainul Abidin, the fourth Imam. And he said that, I praise to the Lord who created me in a way that I am attached to Him. And not to the general people, not to the public. I'm attached to Him and I'm dependent on Him because He is noble. He is almighty. He is all-powerful. He is all-knowing. So when I'm attached to such a person who, or the entity who is all-knowing, who is almighty, who has all the powers, who is perfect Himself, therefore, I will strive for the perfection. And if I will not get attached to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and if I get attached to the general public, or I will be dependent on human beings, then obviously because human beings are also poor like me, they are needy like me, because in the Quran, Allah said that, Ya ayyuhan nas, antumul fuqara'u ilallah. Oh, the mankind, you are needy towards Allah. So Allah is the one towards whom everyone is needy. And when they look towards Allah, when they are needy, when they need something, therefore, I need to be attached to someone. I need to get dependent, or I need to depend on someone who can help me, who is helping everyone. And Imam has said that he praised to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he made him in a way that he is depending on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. May Allah give us tawfiq to be becoming dependent on Allah in its true means. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahana Butt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Several days ahead of the holy month of Ramadan, Kabul residents flocked to the city center to purchase food and necessities for fasting. Afghan markets usually witness a spike in food prices before Ramadan, but this year the situation is much more challenging. Many Afghan families are running short of food amid deepening inflation, unemployment, famine, and poverty.
Ramadan is a blessed month, and Muslims do their best to make full and special preparations. Unfortunately, this year, people are facing an economic decline with little purchasing power. They need rice, flour, oil, beans, egg, and dairy, but many will have to rely on a piece of bread and water this Ramadan.
I was employed only 4 months out of this entire year. I didn't have an income for 8 months. Today, I came to the city center to buy some food items in preparation for fasting the month of Ramadan. But as I saw the prices, I felt like I can't afford anything. The prices have skyrocketed and our cash has less value than before. I think this Ramadan will be the hardest.
This is the second Ramadan since the Taliban took power in August last year, following the catastrophic withdrawal of the U.S. The country's heavily aid-dependent economy, mostly funded by international donors, has been in chaos since the Western countries suspended humanitarian aid and froze Afghan assets.
We used to have an aid-dependent economy. After the political change, it started to crumble as the Western countries cut their aid. Furthermore, economic sanctions and banking restrictions were imposed on Afghanistan. This resulted in people losing their jobs and many factories and small businesses shutting down. In my opinion, the West is committing a crime against humanity in Afghanistan, pushing millions to starvation and death.
According to the United Nations Response Plan, in 2023, two-thirds of the Afghan population need humanitarian assistance. That's a record number of 28.3 million people. This will require funding of $4.6 billion, making it the highest humanitarian requirement in the world. Ramadan is a month of celebration, unity, and compassion. But people in Afghanistan will mark the holy month under the shadow of multiple crises. They are awaiting solidarity and support from the international community. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
A scandal involving a Quran desecration at a school in northern England has continued to escalate, despite the resolution of the affair by the local community. With a local mosque and its imam facing a sustained onslaught by right-wingers in the press and government too. Hafez Mohammed Mateen Anwar played a prominent role in easing tensions after news spread across the community of a Quran desecration by students at Kettlethorpe High School in Wakefield. When the news went viral, talk of an alleged death threat and a street protest erupted. Mateen Anwar offered up his mosque to the school and police as a location for a community meeting, an opportunity to clear the air, lay out the facts, and end the matter once and for all. So behind me is the local mosque where the meeting took place. Now, as far as the local Muslim community are concerned, the situation was dealt with amicably and ended on good terms, with communication playing a big part in making the difference. However, it seems as if the government and also certain right-wing elements within mainstream media appear to be deeply unhappy with the way the story played out. The meeting successfully resolved the affair, with police, the school head teacher and one of the students' mothers all in attendance. But instead of celebrating the peaceful conclusion, the British press ran with inflammatory interpretations of the story.
The police acted, recorded it as a non-crime hate incident, and the boys were, the four pupils were suspended. So that shows that we now have de facto blasphemy laws in the UK.
The mosque is now under investigation by a charity watchdog, while Mateen Anwar has been accused of stoking the row. He is also being portrayed as an extremist over Islamic views he's expressed in the past. Press TV spoke with the embattled imam, who blasted the media for peddling misinformation, such as forcing the mother of a student to attend and apologize.
What's the purpose of that meeting? The purpose of that meeting, Robert, was to let the community know that what you're seeing on social media, these lies, they're not true. Out of those students, one of their mothers, in fact, contacted our team on her own accord and explained how she felt. And she, in fact, herself invited our team to her home address by her own choice. The mother attended the mosque and wanted to sort of relate to the community about how she felt. A number of points were addressed on that meeting, which then led to a really amicable conclusion to this. There's a number of statements I've come across, statements from ministers, statement from the education minister himself, and a number of other political figures, people of media background, who have sadly just followed onto this tangent of lies and continue to progress that further without actually trying to investigate the truth, which is sad. It's really a sad reality that they've not actually investigated what went about. We were successful, Robert, in stopping a demonstration which could have led to further incidents. We were responsible for the reinstation of the children back into the school.
The imam added he's exploring legal options to challenge what he says is an Islamophobic smear campaign against him by right-wing elements who are deeply unhappy with British Muslims successfully standing up for their faith. Robert Carter, Wakefield.
People in the Gaza Strip rallied in front of the Red Cross office on Monday to mark this year's Palestinian Wounded Persons Day. The annual event pays tribute to Palestinians who have got injured during Israeli wars and aggressions. Thousands of injured Palestinians suffer from permanent disabilities caused by Israel. Wounded Palestinians say Israel's crimes will continue to go unpunished as long as the regime is under the protection of Western countries.
Our injuries always remind us of the criminal Zionist enemy who left us scarred for life. The Israeli crimes against the Palestinian people started in 1948 and continue to take place until this day. The world, especially the Western countries, must stop assisting the Israeli regime.
During the 2014 war on Gaza, Israeli forces killed over 2,200 Gazans, including women and children, and injured more than 11,000. In May of 2021, over 2,200 Palestinians were injured, including 685 children and 480 women. The wounded people in Gaza are also suffering from the Israeli blockade, which has created a harsh humanitarian situation in the region.
Gaza Strip, during the last years, witnessed different escalation, which caused so many wounded people who are suffering due to their injuries, severe injuries, and in the same time, the socioeconomic conditions due to the blockade.
Wounded Palestinians in the blockaded territory struggle to cope with their injuries due to a lack of specialized medical facilities to cater for their needs.
We are calling on the international community in order to exert the pressure on Israel, first to stop its offensive on the Palestinian people, and also to end this illegal blockade, to let end the medical instruments and equipments and medicine to Gaza Strip in order to help these people who are in bad need for surgeries and medical treatments.
Medics say Israel's use of unconventional weapons during its wars and aggressions has increased the number of severe injuries among Palestinians.
Israeli regime forces have killed and maimed thousands of Palestinians in the Gaza Strip, including women and children, since 2008. Experts say the international community must end its apathy to Israeli crimes. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
A comprehensive cooperation roadmap aimed at expanding bilateral relations and 7 MOUs to boost trade and cooperation in transportation, agricultural, and cultural fields. The result of Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko's two-day visit to Tehran, celebrating three decades of close ties between Iran and Belarus.
The visit can be considered a turning point in our bilateral relations. It's an opportunity to share our experiences. We have made remarkable progress despite the sanctions, and we have turned threats into opportunities. We are ready to share our experiences with our friend Belarus.
We're both on the same page. We both agree that a multipolar world is emerging. Iran has made great achievements despite Western sanctions and has turned into an important player in the region and the international arena. There's a lot that we can do together.
The high-level talks between the two sides also included a pledge to increase trade volume to $100 million per year.
Both countries are determined to improve their relations and trade. The economic relations between Iran and Belarus are not comparable to the past.
This is the third visit ever to Tehran by a Belarusian president and the first in 17 years.
Belarus and Iran enjoy strong relations, which is reflected in frequent high-level meetings and various agreements. Belarusian officials have described Iran as a strong partner for their country in the region and in the world. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
A leading critic of Israeli aggression against Palestinians, David Miller, who was sacked from his professorship at the University of Bristol in 2021 after a sustained campaign by Britain's Israel lobby targeting him, has addressed a group of Iranian students at the IRIB University in Tehran. He said Western spy agencies in association with the Western media outlets are to be blamed for unrests and riots in various countries, including Syria.
And MI6 also played a key role in the creation of the Free Syria Army and what was termed in British propaganda terms the moderate armed opposition in Syria. And the most shocking thing, I think, is the involvement in the managed massacre of captives in order to present evidence of chemical weapons attacks by the Syrian government.
Moreover, Miller said that the recent unrests, which erupted in some parts of Iran following the death of a young woman, were orchestrated in advance by the United States and the Israeli regime.
The hybrid war strategy against Iran, against so many other enemy states, is led by the United States via a myriad of assets and outlets. One of the key elements is what might be called the small media strategy. U.S. funds are channeled directly and indirectly to a variety of independent media and citizen journalism or media defense organizations.
Miller, who is also the producer of Palestine Declassified show on Press TV, has repeatedly come under attack by Israeli lobbies in the UK for supporting Palestine and revealing the true face of Israeli regime and its Western allies.
Although David Miller has been sacked from university and has been repeatedly pressured by Israeli lobbies, and there are efforts underway to undermine and smear his name and reputation, he believes such attacks will simply strengthen his resolve to continue the fight. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
Creating a world where untold stories are told and unheard voices are heard. The annual IRIB World Service News Awards, dubbed SOAP Media Festival, this year had a lot to celebrate.
It's been a few years that the dynamics are changing and the new world order is emerging. The unipolar world is now turning into a multipolar world. Iran is in a position where it can speed up this process and offer a third viewpoint different from the two narratives that have always existed.
Words that clarify the mission of IRIB World Service. And this is exactly why the Arabic news channel Al Alam swept the IRIB World Service News Awards, taking home wins in nearly every major category, with its sister channel Al Alam Syria TV maintaining front-runner status with its popular talk show Zoom Room.
We are proud to be able to gain a strong foothold in Syria and West Asia in particular by shedding light on the truth and covering stories that are untold about people who have been misrepresented.
I've been with Al Alam for more than 8 years now. I have hosted many TV programs. It's great to be part of a team where the goal is to bring truth to light.
Meanwhile, the Spanish-language news channel Hispan TV, as well as Press TV, were seen as the gold standard of achievement in the television community, winning awards in different sections, including the Best Documentary and the Best News Website. Not to mention that Press TV's Palestine Declassified won the Best Political TV Show.
This is the moment we're in. We're in the end, the dying throes of U.S. hegemony. And as he was saying, I very much agree with, the cultural infrastructure for the ending of hegemony has to be put in place, and that involves media, including news and journalism, which can give a different view on how the world is operating and tell more of the truth about the world. So, you know, the media play a central, important role in all that.
Press TV correspondent Johnny Miller, who has covered the most difficult news stories, including the Rohingya crisis and the developments in Ukraine over the past year, was not left out.
I think two of my heroes, Noam Chomsky and John Pilger, said that they've never seen as much propaganda in the war in Ukraine than in any war that they've reported on or written about, and they've reported right back from Vietnam. So that's telling you a lot. And there's a huge amount of propaganda on Ukraine. Indeed, Ukraine is it's a civil war, but it's also a proxy war between Russia and NATO. And I think we're seeing the beginning of this split between the West and the East, China, Russia, Iran. And we're seeing a challenge to American hegemony and indeed the creation of this new multipolar world.
And according to the head of the Islamic Republic of Iran Broadcasting, IRIB World Service is at the forefront of this propaganda war.
In this unequal war, where IRIB World Service has none of the advantages of mainstream media, from state-of-the-art technology to political support, it has been able to blaze a new trail. The fact that its news channels are frequently banned on different social media platforms is testimony to that. Meanwhile, this also proves in practice that the free flow of information and free speech are nothing more than slogans that are used as political tools by advocates of democracy.
Media play a key role in today's world. They can set the tone for diplomatic endeavors, and they are a tool of international communication. Particularly for the Islamic Republic of Iran, its media outlet can pave the way for diplomacy.
That is why there are great expectations, which means that so far, IRIB World Service has been able to deliver on its responsibilities.
In a world where mainstream media is setting the narrative, IRIB World Service has been able to break the monopoly and offer a new perspective. Gizumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
South Koreans opposed to upcoming joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises took their message to the presidential office. They worry the largest such drills in almost 5 years could lead to direct conflict.
Where did all the efforts for dialogue for each other go? We must stop the terrible threat that will actually lead to the devastation of nuclear war. We have to stop the battle without an exit. That's why we're here.
Last year, North Korea test-launched a record number of ballistic missiles, with the U.S. and South Korea routinely conducting their own missile tests and smaller military drills.
The large-scale joint U.S.-South Korea military exercises had been suspended under previous President Moon Jae-in. But that's not the policy of current President Yoon Suk-yeol, who seeks to strengthen the alliance with the United States with the frequent deployment of U.S. nuclear-capable forces.
The drills are set to include both computer-simulated war games and field exercises. North Korea views the drills as a rehearsal for invasion.
Currently, the South Korea-U.S. joint military exercise is going ahead, generating aggressive tension, and includes a preemptive strike scenario. Wherever there is such a military exercise, tensions on the Korean Peninsula increase.
More large-scale drills with the U.S. are planned for this year, as President Yoon seeks to celebrate the 70th anniversary of South Korea's alliance with the United States. Frank Smith, Seoul.
A ribbon-cutting ceremony to go down in history, opening the production line of Iran's first homegrown jet trainer, Yasin. According to Iran's defense minister, Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Ashtiani, the jet trainer is capable of carrying out combat missions as well as other tactical aerial warfare actions such as close air support or CAS, air-to-ground actions against hostile targets in close proximity of friendly forces.
Training good pilots is extremely important, and now with this homegrown jet trainer, we have technologically evolved significantly. This is considered a major step for our Air Force. The training period will now be shorter and more comprehensive.
Prior to this, jet pilot training was done outside Iran, and due to Western and U.S. sanctions, Iranian pilots could not receive training abroad.
We did ask for assistance, but no country in the world helped us. However, at the end of the day, it worked out for the best because we were able to develop the technology that we needed ourselves. Knowledge-based companies helped us a lot. In particular, I have to point out the design of the engine and also its aerodynamic design. All in all, Yasin is about 800 kilometers lighter than our first prototype, which is a significant achievement.
Iran started designing jet trainers over 10 years ago. Yasin is the second generation of a prototype that was unveiled in 2019. The new version now includes state-of-the-art avionics, engine, landing gear, and full cockpit devices.
With all the equipment installed, this training jet is fully equipped and it can be used for training pilots in all different levels.
But there's more to Yasin than just training fighter jet pilots.
It is also a question of prestige. This jet trainer was made by our own scientists and inventors. Knowledge-based companies played a very important part. Obviously, it means great economic benefits, but other than that, it shows that we can stand on our own feet. This is the most important message.
In the next 2 years, three more Yasin jet trainers will be produced based on the requirements of Iran's Air Force.
Iran has made great achievements in the field of aviation, and this is a symbol of self-sufficiency of the Islamic Republic. Gisumisha Ahmadi, Tehran.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to IRB English Radio. Thank you very much for joining us in a new episode of The House of Truth, Back to Reality. Well, I am Asma. I have the privilege to be your host. And here with me, I have Brother Hassanain from India and Sister Zainab from India as well. Well, I'm so happy to have you here both. Would you please introduce yourself very much briefly?
Assalamu alaikum. I am Zainab Askari from Indian Administrative Kashmir.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Salamu alaikum, sisters. And salamu alaikum, everyone listening to the IRIB English Radio. I'm Hassanain from India.
So, welcome, both of you. So, as we studied literature, we have been through too much of this concept that each character has got more than what you just see or just read in these pages of the book. Like, when you are going to analyze a character, you have to dig deeper and get into the utmost reality of that person, which is when they are sharing some soliloquies. That is, some words you are saying to your own self. Those moments are exactly the moments when you're showing your own true self to your own self, because we usually do not show our reality to others. It is something hidden inside of us, and in some special occasions, even we can see it ourselves. And not many people even can get into that point because they're not very much honest with themselves. Now, in reality, every single one of us has got three dimensions, three, let's say, masks on their face. One is with myself, one is with others, and the other one is
with the friends.
Yeah, with a friend. So, what do you think?
I agree. We do have masks.
Of course.
And there's a face we show to the world. There's a face we show to our family, friends. And there's a face we show to ourselves. We actually are the face that we don't show to anyone is the real form of us.
Yeah.
So now if the question is like, shall we be having dual faces or not? Or I think I agree.
No, there's no question upon that. There
and,
is
and if
such
you arrange
a thing.
This thing in order, I guess, you know, this might be true that, you know, with ourselves is the most real one.
Yeah.
Then with our friends, then with the
half
people.
Real and then with yeah, people yeah. not real at all. Right?
Yeah.
So is it called pretending? The face that we show to our friends and to the other people.
Of course we are pretending.
Why do we have to pretend?
Because we don't want others to know our real colors. We don't want to lose them, maybe. And not even Allah likes that.
To show your true self to others?
I'm not saying exactly that. But as we read in the Dua Kamal as well, like, oh Allah, forgive me for the sins that only you know. Forgive me for the sins. Like, you have not revealed what you know about me. Because mm-hmm. if you reveal that and then, I don't know.
Nobody would look at me.
That dignity will be gone yeah. all. And it's your, you know, mercy on me mm-hmm. that you know all about me. So there should be that one true face should be with Allah. But sometimes there are even people who are not real with even Allah. Because I known people actually, well, in their childhood now, I don't know how they are. For example, they recite prayers when their friends are around, when the family is around. And if someone would have asked, did you offer the Zohar prayers? Like, and they would say, yeah, I did. But they never did. So here they are being, I don't know.
This is called hypocrisy.
Yeah. So they're being, as if playing with Allah as well, showing him another kind of face. But I think at least even if you have dual faces or dual personalities or multiple personalities, yeah. with your Allah should be true at least.
Yeah, so brother.
You know, as you were talking about pretending.
Yeah.
It's... you can call it pretending, but it's not always pretending.
So what
sometimes
is it?
It's your requirement, what you require for the specific moment or specific situation. Because, you know, you cannot be same with random people, with strangers, as you're with your friends.
Yeah.
It's what's the requirement of the time.
So you mean that sometimes it's logic?
Sometimes, you know, I cannot behave in the same way as I with a stranger as I behave mm-hmm. with my friends.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, you know, I'm more comfortable with my friends.
Yeah.
I'm more comfortable when I'm around my family.
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, I won't be the same guy in my friend circle and in random, you know, in a random group of people.
With strangers.
Yeah. So I might be introvert when I'm outside. I might be extrovert when I'm with my friends.
Exactly.
So it's sometimes what is required.
Mm-hmm.
It's not always pretending. It might be sometimes.
I agree.
I agree, yeah.
Yeah, it's totally
I don't know
true.
The principle.
So
opinion,
right
yeah.
now that we have come to an agreement, let's go for a break.
Yeah.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality.
Welcome back. This is still Back to Reality, and we're talking about people, human beings as in general, having different faces and different masks or whatever you just call it. Again, in literature, we have another concept that is called decorum. That is, content and form should come together. Just like what brother said, like when I am with a bunch of people who are strangers, I am going to act accordingly. As someone with shields, I'm protecting myself actually from them. And I guess this is wise. This is being wise, comporting yourself with the situation.
Yeah.
You come to act according to where you are. Of course, when I am with my friends, I'm not going to be that way with the strangers. Or the way I am with my family, I'm not going to be that way with my, for example, and with the people who have come into my life very much recently or newly or things like that. Now, the question is, which one should we trust more? A real one or the one we create to show other people?
Obviously, the one we are.
Mm. The real one is a real you.
Because the one that you don't show to others is the real you.
No, because sometimes I come to the point that I believe that is me. You know what I mean? We have seen it many times around us, that there are people, just as you said, those hypocrite people who do things in front of other people and then they get much of, appreciation from people around them so that they come to the point where they themselves even come to believe that, okay, I am that good of a person. Not the real one, I show it to myself.
You know, first we say, you know, pretending can be according to the need of the time.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we act accordingly. But sometimes it's also hypocrisy.
Yeah.
You know, you showcase yourself